Audio in MP3 of the now more than 40 years old book, Date with the Gods. By Charles Silver. About a direct contact, also later intim sexual contact, to an extraterrestrial woman in Peru in the early 70s. She looking exactly like us. Scanning mistakes may be, which may cause mistakes in this reading audio file. Text can be followed by downloading the online book. Google the title. Book was first published 1977, on these happenings in Peru 2 to 3 years earlier. Prologue. On October 13, 1917, in Fatima, Portugal, 70 miles north of Lisbon, 70,000 people witnessed one of the most amazing events of this century. The sun turned pale, emitted brilliant rays of multicolored light, spun three times on its axis, then power dived dizzily towards the earth. The witnesses fell to their knees, terrified and screaming, believing that the end of the world had come. This was the sixth and last consecutive monthly sighting that year, during which time people reported movements of a tree and the arrival and departure of a cloud-like phenomenon. Among the people present was a correspondent for one of the major news services of the United States of America. The story, and its details, were printed in less than 500 words in some hidden corner of one of our largest newspapers. The World Series of 1917 was getting most of the news coverage that week. People here and in the rest of the world just weren't concerned with three young peasant children who had spoken to the Virgin Mary. The children called this woman Our Lady of Fatima. For more than a quarter of a century, the Fatima incident went virtually unnoticed, except for an occasional article in some religious magazines. Later, the picture changed. Fatima became a subject of universal interest. People began talking about a message to the world given by Our Lady of Fatima, to be revealed in 1960. Somehow that message ended up in the Vatican, and as far as all the research is concerned, no Catholic Church official has ever made any kind of formal statement about this matter in its entirety. However, many Roman Catholic priests and scholars have knowledge of the existence of such a message. It was written by one of the three shepherd children who witnessed the event, Sister Maria das Dores, also known as Sister Bernadette. In 1917, talk about UFOs was not the subject of people's everyday conversations. Flying saucers, Martians, and spaceships were things one read about only in science fiction books. However, when we examine the Holy Scriptures, legend, and mythology from many parts of the world, we continually come across the same old plot: some divinities come from the heavens in some kind of flying chariot. Fire, smoke, light, sound and movement are always described. The idea is the same: the creatures whose presence accompanies this phenomenon are thought to be some type of god, or related to God. They come into some kind of contact with someone. These encounters have been reported in many parts of the world. When the divinity decides it is time to leave, a message is left that eventually becomes religion, mythology, tradition, or legend. Generally, these messages are peaceful, filled with expressions of love, prophetic, spiritual, and, most importantly, they all promise eternal life, utopia, or paradise. Whatever it's called, the imagery remains the same. This same general plot is recorded in many forms throughout the world and throughout the ages. Some of these events can be verified through research and investigation. When that happens, we call it history. In this century, the Fatima incident can be likened to the biblical account of Moses talking to Jehovah on top of Mount Sinai, or to his conversation with the burning bush. If a serious investigator really wants to consider the possibilities, he or she may come up with some answers. Prologue. Talk of UFOs is not uncommon these days. Many people from all over the world have claimed to have had some experience with these types of extraordinary events. But, so far, no one has said anything to either conclusively support or deny their existence. According to a Gallup poll taken in 1973, 15 million Americans say they have seen some sort of UFO. A great deal of science fiction material has been written on the subject of extraterrestrial visitors from outer space, from Jules Verne's novels to the world's most sophisticated motion pictures, television series, and non-fiction books. Modern science has yet to say very much about the outer space phenomena. However, many scholars and investigators are dedicating time to this type of research. As a result, discussions on the subject of UFOs are becoming both more scientific and more commonplace. Authors who write about beings from outer space often refer to them as gods. They cite the holy scriptures of many religions, the Bible, the Ramayana, the Mahabharata, among others, for UFO evidence. Mythology, legend, tradition, and history also indicate and bear witness that the Earth has been visited by cosmonaut gods throughout recorded history. In order to understand science, one must make objective studies and observations. History, legend, and tradition require that one take into consideration their sources and make unbiased deductions. For the deepest understanding of religion, one must also have faith. Often science, history, religion, and legend merge, forming a comprehensive picture of the actual events which have inspired such accounts. This book is one account of an incredible experience that this author would like to share with the reader, or perhaps with some 144,000 people in this world who have enough wisdom and understanding to see in its pages a parallel to the Fatima incident. Why 144,000? That was the number given to a man who had a vision on the island of Patmos some 2,000 years ago, thereby inspiring the Book of Revelations. Keep in mind that 144 is the product of 12 times 12. 12 is also the number of signs in their zodiac, the disciples of Jesus the Christ, the tribes of Israel, months in a year, and represents many other things related to astrology and astronomy, that is, the stars. Contained in this book is the exact text of the Fatima message as it was given to those three shepherd children. The reader can make his or her own deductions and come to an independent conclusion after reading it. This time, however, the message will not be given to a church organization. It will go to a publishing company, and I sincerely hope it reaches you. Before I actually began writing this story, I had many second thoughts. I couldn't even conceive that something like this could have happened, even though I had personally experienced the events related in this book. How can a person doubt his own experiences? In this case, it was probably because of my unusual religious upbringing. I was raised with the teachings of both the Jewish and Christian religions, and had participated in the rites and rituals of both. My parents agreed that I would be taught both Orthodox kosher Jewish and Roman Catholic belief systems. Therefore, by the time I was 9 or 10, I was a very confused child in our innators of religion. When I reached the age of 13, I had had both a first communion and a bar mitzvah. As a teenager, I became very rebellious against the guilt that came in the wake of my religious upbringing. By the time I finished high school, I had come to the conclusion that rabbis and priests teach things as far-fetched as any talk about UFOs and visits to this earth by gods from outer space. I learned to be very skeptical of what other people told me to believe, especially religious authorities. One important benefit I received from my background was an international education. Both of my parents were world travelers and I went to high schools and colleges in many parts of the world. As a result, I received more than mere academic knowledge. I learned about life and people from diverse cultures. That was sufficient for me to land a job as a junior executive on the 10th floor of a large international corporation, whose headquarters were located in one of the larger buildings in New York City. Having such a job, and being able to speak several languages, enabled me to travel to many places in many countries. In 1974, when these events took place, I considered myself to be an average person. I belonged to the do-your-own-thing crowd. I kept up with the Joneses, fought traffic, commuted, went to parties, work and the movies. I liked sports, and did all the ordinary things that average people all over the world do in their everyday lives. Accounts of flying saucers seemed irrelevant, or at best, a subject only for talk at parties, the barber shop, or the local pub. It never goes much beyond that, because most people have been conditioned to believing that anyone who sees a flying saucer is either crazy or high on something. Before, my knowledge of UFOs was probably the same as that of any average world citizen. I am not a writer. I am simply an ordinary person who has a story to tell. My intention is to relate the experience as it actually happened, rather than to create one. I ask you to judge this book by the content, rather than the form in which it was written. Our purpose is not to prove the existence of flying saucers. This is a detailed account of a personal experience. To get the full benefit from this message, it would be advisable to keep an open mind. A few sources of information already in print might be useful to help support this premise. An author by the name of Eric von Daniken, and many like him, have been doing research on UFOs, giving lectures, and publishing fully illustrated, documented books, complete with facts, photographs, maps, scientific evidence and other relevant material. Von Daniken is a modern scientist who is looking for answers to the questions left here by the gods, angels, cosmonauts, chariots of fire, and flying saucers of legend, tradition and history. All of these, says von Daniken, have been visiting the Earth for thousands of years. Many thanks are due these brilliant scientists for their courage to face prevailing cynicism in order to tell the world, in easy-to-understand language, supported by documented evidence, that UFOs are not fiction. Without Mr. von Daniken's studies and published evidence, I would never have dared to tell my story. I would have feared that people would think I am either a nut, or someone seeking publicity. My fear of ridicule, however, was not as great as the guilt I knew I would feel if I didn't share these enlightening experiences with others. At least for those who want to understand the connection between worldwide holy scriptures and the headlines today. I also felt this story was particularly important for the present time because the world is experiencing much turmoil from wars, pollution, earthquakes, changes in climate, racial unrest, crime, terrorism, and the threat of nuclear devastation, conditions which the Bible describes as being evidence that the earth is now living in its last days. What you are about to read took place in 1974, in the very same land where gods, angels, and divinities have been recorded by our ancestors for thousands of years in the form of scriptures, works of art, legends and colossal monuments. UFO sightings, contacts with alien beings, trips to other planets, and interplanetary pregnancies, have all been reported by ordinary individuals all throughout South America for many years, right up to the present day. If you have a Bible, it would be useful to have it handy for reference, as it would be of great value to anyone trying to understand certain concepts. The names of persons and places mentioned in this book have not been changed. They are real places and real people. Since this is a world of reality, and this is a journalistic report, I used the names and trademarks that were part of the story, never meaning to misrepresent them in any way. It began on June 16, 1974, with a Braniff International flight to Lima, Peru, from Los Angeles, California. A junior executive with a large United States international corporation was going on a business trip for a few weeks. Chapter 1, Discovering the Andes. Arriving at the Jorge Chavez International Airport in Lima, Peru, at 7 in the morning was an experience I had gone through many times. The familiar rituals of going past immigration and customs, as well as renting a car, went smoothly. It felt good being back again. The easygoing pace in South America was always a welcome contrast to the rush of big American cities. After checking into the Lima Sheraton Hotel, I went out, had some breakfast, and reported to our Peruvian office for my assignments. As I had anticipated, my stay was set for a few weeks. I looked forward to a round of pleasant, relaxed work which would give me the feeling of productiveness I felt I needed. As I was leaving the office that afternoon, I saw a notice posted on the bulletin board. A 4-day weekend was coming up, and I would have the opportunity to be a tourist for a few days and perhaps venture outside of Lima. Traveling on business makes one a traveler. Doing it for pleasure, one becomes a tourist. On my previous trips to Peru, I had visited some nearby towns and cities, but had not ventured further due to lack of time. Peru is a nation about 3 times the size of the state of California, with 3 contrasting climates. It has a lot to offer in the tourism department, and in this modern jet era, one can get to and from the many interesting places in no more than 2 hours. The subject of the long weekend came up in a conversation with Nancy, the secretary at our Lima office. Since she had no plans for the long weekend either, we decided to take a trip together to a city called Huancayo, located high in the Andes Mountains. Nancy recommended Huancayo because it was where tourists went to see the Sunday Fair, that city's main feature, in addition to the lovely climate, good food and things to buy, and, most important of all, a relaxing atmosphere conducive to a few days' rest. We planned to leave right after work Thursday evening and to return the following Monday afternoon. For the next 2 days, I looked forward to an idyllic, honeymoon-like weekend that would take me away from my fellow human beings. My body was hypertensive from living in large cities such as New York, Los Angeles, London, Paris, Rome, where people bumped into each other on crowded streets, elevators and trains. I was also tired of hustling waiters, catching the 509 to Babylon, battling congested traffic and living with the fear of being mugged. The weekend in Huancayo with Nancy promised a little rest and made me feel at ease. For a few days I could throw aside the suit and tie, forget business and have some fun. About half an hour before departure time on Thursday, Nancy called and said she couldn't go. Something about her aunt. Blast it. Not for a minute did I believe her story. Angry and hurt, I went out driving to a local resort and stopped at a nightclub, where I drank and brooded about my ruined weekend. Before I knew it, I was very drunk. Later, as I drove back to the hotel in my inebriated condition, I remembered that the car rental company had told me the rented car I was driving had already been prepared for driving conditions in the Andes Mountains. Rather than let this sudden change in plans spoil my fun and long weekend, I thought, I would make my way to Huancayo by myself. By 9 o'clock Friday morning I had gotten a few things together and was driving towards the mountains alone. It was dark and gloomy when I left Lima, but the sunless dismal day suited my mood. I felt like a rag, I had a hangover, complete with a splitting headache and queasy stomach. After I had been driving for about 45 minutes, the weather changed. The sun came out and with it appeared blue water, beautiful green valleys and small villages with grazing cattle and happy natives working in the fields. I began to feel better immediately. I stopped at a small village and had an Alka-Seltzer with mineral water to ease my stomach. I later discovered that this beautiful spot was the beginning of the Andes Mountains. The refreshing, clean air was a real treat to my lungs. The people at the restaurant told me I had another 6 to 7 hours driving time to Huancayo, which was about 10 miles further. Since I had already covered 75 miles in 1.5 hours, it didn't make any sense that it would take 6 hours to cover 225 miles. But I soon found out why. As I continued my drive toward Huancayo, the road began to deteriorate with large holes, bumps and ruts. All I could see was a road winding like an endless serpent into the high peaks of the Andes Mountains. When I passed a small mining village, a sign indicated the altitude was 3,746 meters, 11,238 feet above sea level. The altitude was getting to me, but the worst was yet to come. The higher I went, the sicker I became. I was dizzy, nauseous and my murderous headache returned. I stopped at a nearby mining center, Casapelca, where I was given oxygen. I wasn't sure if the altitude was bothering me or if I was still suffering the effects of the hangover. A nurse at the center assured me that even people who never drink get the worst kind of altitude sickness in that part of the Andes. Ticlio. A cold, barren spot is the highest point of the Lima Huanqueo Drive. A railroad crossing intersects there. Road and a sign says, Punto Ferroviario Más Alto del Mundo, highest railway point in the world. A figure is given in both meters and feet, 4,818 meters and 15,806 feet above sea level. Reading that made me even sicker. I stopped the car and had to throw up. As my nausea eased, I looked up and saw another sign. This one said, Existen los platillos voladores, contacto con ovnis, or, flying saucers do exist, UFO contact point. Below that were some words in Spanish to the effect that one should be prepared to meet them. Even in my misery at that moment, I managed an uncomfortable smirk. I was in no mood for jokes. I figured some Peruvian clown had gone to a lot of trouble, coming all the way to this high point of the world, 16,000 feet above sea level, to put up a crazy sign. If any place could be called the middle of nowhere, this was it. The drive got smooth there as I continued my journey. The road, paved at some intervals, started descending. From that high point, one of the most beautiful natural panoramas I had ever seen unfolded in front of my eyes. The mountainous terrain was filled with large cliffs, blue lakes, steep canyons and rolling green hills. I paused to ponder the triumph of engineering that was able to build a railroad at this altitude in this kind of topography. It was a little past 4 when I arrived in Huanqueo. In spite of the height, it was warm and sunny. The beauty of the countryside soothed my mood, and though I still had a slight headache, I was beginning to feel like my old self. I drove around the city for a while, but found nothing charming about it. It was commercial, big, dirty, and contained no visible tourist attractions to speak of. What a bummer, I thought, marooned here until the Sunday fair. I tried to console myself that the beauty of the countryside made the trip worthwhile. I brought the car to a halt in front of the Hotel de Turistas at Huanqueo Civic Center. As I walked into the front door of the hotel, to my surprise I saw an old college classmate friend of mine. We both said at the same time, "What a small world, and what in heaven's name are you doing here? Richard, after not seeing you for 5 years, here I find you at the top of the Andes Mountains," I said. "Yes, I'm with the Peace Corps," he said. "Peace Corps, CIA is more like it." "Oh, come on, Chicho, you're beginning to sound like that History 102 teacher we used to have." "Who cares, Richard? I want to get settled. I'm beat." "Are you staying in the hotel?" Richard asked. "Not yet, I've just come in. I'm about to check in, I came to see the Sunday fair." "Oh, really? That's something well worth seeing," he commented. "So I've been told by the lady who was supposed to come with me," I said, but she chickened out at the last minute. "Listen," Richard said, "you can stay with me. But first let's go and get a good meal." At that point I didn't feel like eating anything, but it was good to hear English spoken, so I accepted. I followed him to the Ristorante Olimpico, located in the downtown area of the city. I watched Richard order a full course meal. I was afraid my altitude sickness and nausea might return, so I ordered only coffee and toast. We sat for nearly an hour and recounted the past 5 years of our lives. I told him about my adventures getting through those mountains. And I complained about the circumstances for which I was sleeping alone this long weekend. I described the beautiful places I'd seen driving to Huanqueo. We both agreed this was indeed an enchanting land. Richard told me about a place, not too far from there, maybe 1 hour's drive, where one could bathe in warm medicinal waters fed by volcanic springs, which when coupled with the beauty and serenity of the countryside, made this an Andes Shangri-La. It sounded great, so I made plans to go there that evening. When he saw how impressed I was by his bike, He said he wouldn't mind trading it for my car for a day or two. He also offered to entertain me that evening, but said he was seeing a couple of girls who had arrived in Huancayo that day. He suggested a double date with them Saturday night. The offers sounded great, impossible to refuse, as I am, number one, a motorcycle freak, and, number two, always available when it comes to ladies. Armed with just my toothbrush, shaving gear, Richard's directions and the motorcycle, I headed out for the hotel at the Warm Water Springs. By the time I got there it was quite dark, and very cold. I was ready for a good night's sleep. A chiropact, population 25, and that's pushing it, has maybe 12 or 15 houses in the whole community. There are two hotels that offer a comfortable bed, a few thick, coarse wool blankets and a bedspread. There are no sheets, no heat, and no toilets. A table and a chair completed the accommodations, but under the circumstances, I was grateful to have these offerings. The people were warm and friendly, so I felt at home immediately. I had just enough strength left to hit the miracle medicinal waters before retiring for the night. The lady at the hotel gave me a gas lamp and the keys to a dilapidated adobe-like bathhouse, located on the shore of the Mantaro River, just a short distance away. Inside the bathhouse was a square hole in the ground, maybe 6 feet deep and 12 to 15 feet in length and width. One wooden bench, and some nails on the wall where I could hang my clothes. The place smelled like a sulfur mine. The water content was high in minerals, sulfur, iron, zinc and vanadium. It was very cold, but I quickly took off my clothes and jumped into the water. It was like bathing in champagne. Millions of tiny bubbles started building up all over me. Then the tremendous carbonation caused goose pimples to appear over every inch of my body. What a magnificent feeling. It was the first relaxing moment I'd had in a long time. Far from the maddening crowd, this was indeed an ideal place for peace and quiet. I immediately decided to stay in this part of the world for my entire weekend. The water was naturally warm. Getting out of it in the below zero temperature took a lot of courage. Not even at Reveille in the army had I seen anyone get clothes on their body as quickly as I did that night. I raced up the hill to the hotel to have some hot soup to help warm me. Despite my fatigue, when I finally got into bed I lay awake, thinking of all the events that had led me to this most beautiful place in the mountains. I was still feeling sorry for myself and angry about having to sleep alone. I wondered why Nancy had decided to cancel our date at the last minute. I played back the whole Lima Huancayo trip, including my reaction to the altitude, meeting Richard after 5 years and getting the motorcycle that brought me to this lovely place. The strangest thing of all kept surfacing in my mind, the UFO contact sign. Knowing that tomorrow was another day, I grumbled, "Que sera sera, whatever will be," and fell into a deep, peaceful sleep. Chapter 2. My first UFOs. Saturday morning I awoke to the peaceful, quiet beauty of an Andean sunrise. There was not one cloud in the bright blue sky. The only place in the world where I remember ever seeing a sky like that was in Greece some years ago. I got out of bed to the sound of the flowing river and singing birds. A gentle, caressing breeze completed the perfection of that moment. The day promised to be a good one to ride around the Andes Mountains on Richard's motorcycle. I felt relaxed and refreshed without a trace of yesterday's ills. Apparently my whole system had already become acclimated to the extremely high altitude. I dressed quickly and hurried down to the bathhouse. I was lucky to find an open pool, because Saturday was the day many people come here to take their mineral bath. I stayed in the water about half an hour before realizing my appetite had returned. I went back to the hotel for a hearty and delicious breakfast. Then I got on the bike and drove around the mountains and valleys without a thought of the big city. No traffic lights, pollution, speed signs or traffic anywhere. For the first time I was able to open up the throttle on the four-cylinder Honda. The only sounds I heard were those produced by the echo of this powerful bike racing full blast. I was thoroughly enjoying myself. Suddenly I realized I was approaching the top of the Lima Huaqueo Drive, about 40 kilometers from where I had seen the UFO contact sign yesterday.